Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Dr. Josh Tewksbury, Director of the Future Earth Global Hub in Colorado, an editor of Future Earth's in-house magazine, Anthropocene, an ecologist, evolutionary biologist, and conservation biologist by training. Josh has over 20 years of active research on the impacts of climate on animals and plants, but has found his way to a leading role in steering Future Earth, focused on research, innovation, and collaboration in order to transform the world towards sustainability. I spoke to Josh online from his office in Colorado. So Josh, welcome to Change Hackers.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's really great to have you on the show. Now, look, you've been at this game for a while and immersed in the whole business of sustainability, climate, oceans, both as an academic, but also with an NGO hat on. And now you've got this really interesting role at Future Earth. I don't know where to start with you. I mean, there's so much going on here, but maybe we'll just start with your passions. You know, how did you get into this in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tony. So I think I'm not unlike a lot of academics a lot of people who started as academics, and many who still are, who feel like they got into that field, into that game, because they wanted to create change in the world. Whether it's and sustainability is all about a change agenda. And for many academics, I think the system itself proves to be hard to change, and it's actually the signposts and the roadmaps and the pathways for academics to have the impact that they want to have in their careers on the trajectory of our planet and the people on that planet. It's opaque. It's hard. They're hard to find. There aren't a lot of signposts or guides, and you end up getting stuck in something of a that sort of classic academic frame in which you go into the field because you want to create a difference, but you're passionate about the questions that you can answer. And at some point in your career, you realize that you're chasing questions rather than chasing impact.
Right.
And I think that I suffered from that in a big way. I spent 10 years trying to figure out why wild chili peppers are hot. That is a really fun question to answer. And it's a question that you can talk about and people care about it and you can do interviews on it. And if we don't figure that out for the next 1,000 years, we're probably still okay. And at the same time,
unless you produce Scotch bonnets, or
oh yes, right, it's fantastic for a few, and it's totally interesting science, and I loved it. And I got to tromp around South America and the wilds of Bolivia, searching for new chili pepper species, trying to understand the evolution of the heat in the pepper. Totally fun stuff. Not the most important questions for sustainability today. Not a bad question. Super excited about it. But if I just step back from that and say, why did I get into this? And what am I doing now? Does that actually reflect why I got into it? I'd have to say no. Like I wasn't being true to myself in that space. And so and as a lot of people, you head down, you get through tenure, you pop back up again, and you start evaluating and figure out what you want to do. And as a side note, I think that's a very big problem with academia, that we have our very brightest minds go head down for 5, 6, 7 years before they actually step back to figure out what they want to do. But that is exactly what we do. And that is what I did.
And the whole system is game towards doing that. That's how you got on, isn't it? Increased specialization, and you go down a rabbit hole.
You go down a rabbit hole, and you are absolutely rewarded for going deep down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And there is a place for that. And actually, it's really important that academia preserve a space for deep understanding of what sometimes seem to be less than the most important questions, because discovery is about the unknown, and you don't get there unless you plumb the depths. But that said, we also have to make it easy for those who recognize early that they want to integrate, that they want to work across disciplines, that they want to connect across sectors of society, that also is a viable and important and supported path in academia. And we haven't done that. We spent 150 years digging deep in how to support disciplinary science, and we've just started to think about how we support interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary science.
What has that meant for you as an individual, having legitimacy on questions outside of your recognized field of expertise?
Well, what it meant was that when I first kind of woke up in the University of Washington and decided to really start pushing hard and leaning into the more integrative part of the agenda and thinking about how an institutional structure like a world-class research institution can marshal its combined talent to go after the big questions that are standing between us and the 2030 agenda or the Sustainable Development Goals. When I started that, I spent 5 years trying to create a college focused on the major environmental issues of our time. And we were successful in creating that college after a huge effort and a ton of fight. And I was fundamentally dissatisfied with the amount of change that took place in the institution, even after that large push. And I don't think that's particular to the University of Washington. I think it's particular to academia. In other words, you can put a shiny new title on a department, but that doesn't ensure that the people inside that department or college are acting any differently. And it's very hard to get academics within traditional academic departments to shift into more transdisciplinary or even interdisciplinary modes of working because the incentives don't align that way and the funding doesn't align that way. So simply putting a new college of the environment in a university, particularly when you're not the first, second, third, or fourth university doing that, doesn't necessarily shift the thinking of the institution. I think since then it has done some good shifts, but it's slow and incremental. And I was really pushing for change, and I got frustrated with the results. And so I one of the things I've learned is if you voice those frustrations to the wrong people, it can dramatically change your career path. And so I ended up.
You were shown the door.
I was. I mean, I was shown an opportunity for another door, inadvertently, yes, it did mean that I took a big shift. And I started the Luke Hoffman Institute in Geneva with WWF because that the opportunity to be the founding director there was this amazing opportunity to try and do science, not in academia, but to do science within civil society. And there is nothing more humbling and more important than recognizing how science fits in to other aspects of society for changing the way you think about that enterprise. And that's what I was given the opportunity to do. I mean, I was given, this tremendous sort of blank slate of, we know we want to dig deep into science and we want that science to connect fundamentally to the conservation work we're doing all over the world. WWF runs about $1 billion of programs across the world, and its science capacity, like all the major environmental NGOs, is quite small compared to its programming capacity. And they were very interested in bringing that science into that programming. And when you shift and you start doing science in that capacity, it's wonderful because and it's wonderfully humbling because you recognize that you are just another tool. So WWF or TNC or any of the major NGOs, they have a policy or a behavior change or a political nut they need to turn. And they know where that nut needs to go. And if your science wrench can help turn that nut, you are up at the table and everyone's behind you. But as soon as it doesn't fit, they'll just find another wrench. That's totally different than it is in academia. There's no you are constantly being asked to prove your value in civil society as a scientist in a way that you're not.
Well, you're in service of others.
Because you're in service of others. It's not just about discovery. It's about discovery that has impact. And I realized that, I like this. I don't think this is easy, but I like it. I like that pushback on where's the impact? How is it going to change things on the ground? We have so many vitally important decisions to make that require the best possible evidence. And we so often fail to get that evidence at the big tables. And so one of the things that I realized in that shift is that academia is very good at creating opportunities for scientists to create their own small table and sit at the front of it. And what we need is science to join big tables at the side, because it's not going to run the decisions. It shouldn't. Because the major decisions we need to make in the world are decisions that involve far more than science. But if we make them without science at that table, and I fear we do that over and over again today, then we're not really taking advantage and using the capacity that we're amassing in all of our, all of our discovery institutions all over the world, the top universities around the world, the think tanks around the world that are dedicated to the understanding of our place on this planet and its impact. So I feel like we need to think about more and more about how you get science at the side of big tables. And that's what I think you do in organizations like WWF. Well, some parts of WWF, not all of it, but certainly the science parts. And then certainly that's the mission of Future Earth. So I feel like I finally sort of hit an organization like, oh, this is actually, this whole organization is set up to do this. And and that's why
some point. So at some point you've begun to see yourself as a bridge builder between mm-hmm. science and politics or business or
or communication and all of that. So a lot of what do, you know, now is, you know, recognizing that that the science is absolutely essential and not near sufficient. And part of it is that the system in which science is developed is really insular. And that insular system of discovery and the sort of broken model we have in which we think knowledge is transferred into action is a really leaky pipe, and it needs to be fully rethought, and it needs a lot of attention by all actors to do that. And the primary reason we need that now is because we don't have an infinite amount of time to solve the problems we're facing now. We have a very finite amount of time. And the decisions we make now will have massive implications for ourselves and our children and our grandchildren and all the other species on the planet within the next 25 years. And so...
So one of my guests, Cressy Westling, is an eco-entrepreneur, mm-hmm. turns waste products into desirable goods.
Yeah.
And she commented about science, particularly climate scientists, I think she was thinking of, as being what she describes as in pre-traumatic stress. You know, they can see it coming and they're getting really stressed about it and can't understand why everyone else can't see the problem coming. I fully recognize what you say in terms of the, you know, the kind of the evidence base, you know, but we've been trying this for quite a long time, and you know, science has, you know, to some extent succeeded. You know, the needle's definitely shifted in politics and in business and elsewhere. But it's not nearly as far as it's gone. Where do you think science is failing?
Well, I think in some ways, the institutional structures within which most of science is based are perhaps the most antiquated institutional structures we have today in current modern civilization. I mean, I do feel like if you took someone out of a time machine from the 1840s and dropped them down today, the only place they could walk into and recognize exactly where they are would be a university. Because it hasn't changed very much, and everything else has, and I feel like that your other guest who was speaking about this is absolutely right that it's that, you know, climate scientists and I would say scientists who have been focusing on biodiversity and on the evolution and on many development issues as well, it's not an easy time to do that work because you don't feel very well supported. You know, the Catcher in the Rye. You know, there's a sequence in that where Holden Caulfield is out in this, he's having a dream, and he's out in this field of ryegrass, and his job is to catch these children who are running through the field of rye towards cliffs, and they're going to fall off these cliffs, and his whole job in this dream is to catch these children and keep them from falling. And that's the place that every biodiversity scientist is right now, in that dream. And it's a terribly lonely place to be. And that's also the place that many of our climate scientists are, in that dream. And they are trying to figure out how to work not alone, but together and with other sectors of society to create change. So they're not stuck trying to save this ecosystem, this species. I mean, these are people that have devoted their lives to understanding these systems. And all of their understanding is not enough to save them. That's a lonely place. And we fail them by not providing really strong mechanisms for that understanding to translate so that it's not just them alone in that field, but it's all of us working together to surround those children, to surround what we believe in and support it. And we can do this, but we too often fail to organize in a way that allows us to do it. Hmm.
I wonder to what extent the meta-narrative around climate change and sustainability, you know, is culpable for people's reaction to the evidence that's laid out in front of them. You know, too often it seems as though we're running away from a cliff rather than towards something more optimistic, more attractive than where we currently are.
I mean, this is so I've started this magazine Anthropocene magazine, explicitly to have that dialogue. So that's probably the most fun part of my job, is producing that magazine. And it's, and I work with a phenomenal editor in chief, but the whole point of that is that we need to start having conversations that we're not having today about the world that is human dominated, that we live in, that we actually want to live in. And that's, I think, what you're saying, is that there are solutions out there. There are narratives out there. There is progress that is not getting through the sort of the meta narrative that is, you know, which is we're heading towards these cliffs. And we don't spend near enough time envisioning the world we want to live in. We spend a lot of time, you know, painting the picture of the world we think we're going to live in. And there's, you know, there's a thousand journalistic outlets for sort of documenting the decline. And we wanted to start something that's like all about solutions. How do you actually have conversations about the really difficult issues, about synthetic biology, about geoengineering, about how much energy we really need, you know, about whether we should leave fossil fuel reserves in the ground? And how do you do it in a way that doesn't polarize, but pushes people, all of us, a little bit out of our comfort zones, to recognize the possibility and to think progressively around what our new technologies and our new institutions and new possibilities in governance can mean for moving us through this you know, decidedly difficult time.
It always struck me that Stephen Hawking, God rest his soul, was, you know, amongst a very, very few number of scientists globally who had this capacity, ironically, in fact, given his disabilities, to communicate in plain English with lay people in such an optimistic, relevant way about how science, what science means for their lives and what it means for the future and the future of civilization and humanity. We have too few people like that in science with that ability to be able to reach across and bridge that divide.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's true. And he really understood his position in that space. And there's a few others. I mean, you know, I would say in biodiversity, I think David Attenborough understands his role there as well. And and there are a few others who are also in that space, the sort of public scientist for major sectors of our understanding of the world and its relationship to our actions. There are too few of those. We absolutely need a stronger, younger generation of voices for science, more diverse, younger, from around the world, really speaking to the global nature of this enterprise of understanding our world and our place within it. And it's in the vitality of that to the questions and the importance of that to the questions we're facing around the world as a society. And groups like the Global Young Academy, for example, is a fantastic organization trying to do that, trying to support the younger generation of just phenomenally bright scientists around the world in all disciplines and in the arts and the humanities as well, to sort of recognize, to give a platform for these individuals to shine more brightly around the world. You know, it's a small effort. There needs to be more of those efforts. And the other piece, I think, is that Stephen and a few others have done it on their own, right? In order to do it at scale, we do need what we often call boundary organizations. And Global Young Academy is one. Future Earth is another. You know, Anthropocene Magazine is a great example of, like, when we want to tell the most compelling stories about science, innovation, and sustainability, I don't turn to scientists to tell those stories. I turn to writers to tell those stories. Because professional communicators and writers, those are people who spent their entire lives really trying to understand what a narrative is. And you need to connect those fundamental narrative artists with those shining lights in science who are focused primarily on understanding and driving an understanding of our potential future into action. And I think there's a sweet spot there that needs to be connected more often and more consistently. There is a traditional worry among many scientists about the relationship between their work and the press. And the first thing that scientists can do is get over that and recognize that they will make mistakes, and that's okay, and that they can recover. I think I had probably the most embarrassing, you know, major publication article about me that, well, one of the most ones that wasn't like, you know, embarrassing in a non-libelous way. I mean, people have been slandered in much worse ways, but and I recovered from it fine. And it taught me a lot about how to work with the press. So I took a journalist with me when I went to Bolivia for a long trip, and we had a great trip, but I forgot that he was a journalist, you know, sort of standard, you know, rookie mistake of, you know, recognizing that he's there to tell a story and his job is to tell the most compelling story. And if I don't really give him the clues of what that most compelling story is, he's going to do it himself because that's his job. And so the story that came up was not exactly the story that I wanted told, and not really the story that my department wanted told. I mean, I think the title was Gonzo Botanist or something, right? It's not terribly scientific. And yet, like, that process and then has led to a relationship with that writer that is ongoing, and I still respect him greatly. And it has allowed me to understand the role more effectively. So I guess what I would say is it's not simply about making all scientists great communicators. It's about allowing scientists the capacity to fail and get up and to work collaboratively with journalists and writers, and in some cases to become those journalists and writers. But I think that's the exception rather than the rule, just because it takes, like, writing is a craft just like science. And some of them,
but at the very least, understand what the writer's trying to achieve.
Absolutely. And recognize, yeah, exactly. And
help, you know, help them do their job.
Help them do their job. And be, because they have a job to do. And if every scientist doesn't know five writers well enough to go out for beers or for dinner or for lunch, that part of their job, they should be doing that part of their job.
They're the people that are going to help surface their work.
Exactly, because you can't, if you're going to be going deep in a certain scientific field, you can't surface it yourself necessarily, but you absolutely have to cultivate those relationships to allow others to tap your expertise and get that to the right place. And really to spend that sort of, like, one of the ways that I thought, you know, institutionally we don't support it is, you know, at least in the United States, our models for academic, you know, professors are typically, you know, something like 40% research and 40% teaching and then 20% service. And no one gets graded on the quality of their service. Almost no one. And yet that's the part that's going to connect that science to the rest of the world. That's the part that's going to make the difference between whether we make the 2030 agenda in 2030 or 2100. Like, it is that service part of the science that needs to be reversed and emphasized if we're ever going to be able to extract the knowledge at the pace we need to extract it from the institutions that are generating it. I don't know how many top-level public institutions are fundamentally sort of separated from the cities they dwell in, most of them. And, you know, it's that ivory tower syndrome. In the United States, we had this system that was supposed to break that down. It was called the land grant system. And we have eroded that in our country and really focused on fundamental research. And there is nothing wrong with fundamental research. It's essential, but again, it's just not sufficient. You absolutely have to have these professors of practice, these connections between sectors of society that are going to create the glue and create really the signposts for the more fundamental researchers to understand how their work can plug in. Without that ecosystem engineering, we end up with silos. And silos won't drive us forward, and they certainly won't solve our problems, the big problems we have today.
Which brings us back to the integrative thinking that we started out on. I can't help being reminded of the original Enlightenment period that we went through in the 17th century. And well before that, you know, with characters like Galileo and then Da Vinci and then latterly the Newtons. And, you know, these people were polymaths.
Yeah.
They were deep specialists in a whole number of different areas.
So, yes, absolutely.
You know, and I wonder if, you know, the age of the polymath is going to come round again.
This is where getting to whether your glass is half full or half empty is important. And I think you can't be in this field unless you're optimistic of the opportunity, of the opportunities for that kind of stage shift or state shift in the role of knowledge creators and knowledge integrators within our society. But I think we're a long way from an ecosystem that would support that. And, you know, like any process, it's not actually the way we'll get there, and the reasons for being there will be fundamentally different from the reasons that allowed the original Enlightenment to have those kind of individuals. You know, when you're dealing with a blank slate, and you have societies in which most of your wealthy class are the only ones really able to sort of establish themselves within these positions. And you have like the entire world of knowledge sort of open to you. Yeah, you can create these phenomenal polymaths, and that's great. Today, we need to do it again, but for very different reasons and under very different conditions. And they need to come from really not the same places, because the sustainable development goals are only going to work if they are embedded in the cultural and national contexts around the world. And what happens in the UK and the US and Norway is going to be fundamentally different than what's going to happen in India and China and Kenya. And all of those places need their Galileo. And the Galileo from my country is not going to be sufficient to drive the change around the world. We need icons that speak to the cultural context in which different nations are in. And that means the need for building and supporting the talent that comes up from around the world is far greater than it ever has been in the past. It is the only way we're going to create our sustainability, because you know, sustainability is just not going to happen if it doesn't happen to India and to China and Africa. And that's not going to happen because some white dude got really good at 7 or 8 different fields. It's going to happen because every country has its own people digging deeply into their own social constructs and becoming their own thought leaders. And that collectively as a society, we're supporting that kind of integration. And that's, you know, in a way, I think that's what Future Earth is supposed to be doing. It's a really hard job. It can't do it alone. It's only part of an ecosystem. But we do live in a society now in which the leaders around the world in science, in innovation, in business need to come together, need to talk more about hard topics, and need to start trusting each other more across boundaries, and then go back to their contexts and create change.
Yeah, which requires a lot less in the way of heroic individuals.
That seems to me. So true. You know, so true. Know, yeah.
We've talked before about the scientists as change agents, but you know, there's a humility, a modesty that comes with that too. You know, so yes, a deep desire to drive change, be part of driving change, to leverage your expertise in service of society, but recognize you're not going to be the hero. It's not going to fuel an ego. By
no,
doing that.
So I mean,
you know, you're going to be one of an army of people around the world.
It's so true. So I think what we need now is science as service. We've had 150 years of the sage on the stage, of hero scientist models, of individual labs and individual discoveries being sort of held up as the beacon of hope. That's not what's going to work going forward. Science is like any other service profession. We are. You know, we're no real different than any other service. If you have a bunch of garbage on the street, people have got to come together and you got to clean up that garbage, right? That's, you know, what trash collectors do. That's a fundamental service for society. We're doing home improvement at scale now. We're doing it at a planetary scale. And science is a big part of that home improvement. And home improvement isn't about heroes, it's about service. So, you know, when you think about science as service, it's about team science. It's about humility. It's about working across contexts. It's also recognizing that we're not going to get there thinking that there's a silver bullet solution. We're going to get there by adding up the silver buckshot, by working really hard to find those innovations and scale those innovations that will solve a particular piece of the problem, and then connecting those innovations over and over and over again to create the transformation that we need to live sustainably on this planet.
You talk almost as though we're already there. The thing that really strikes me about you and your journey though here is that, you know, you've become a champion for a different way of working. Yeah. You know, not the only one. You're not the only voice for this, but you're a loud voice. As an advocate for a different relationship between science and the rest of society, and I applaud that. But you've had to fight your way through to have a platform for that, and thank God something like Future Earth has come along, and Luke Hoffman Institute before that, to support you along your way. You know, how much harder might that journey have been had it not been for sponsors?
It would be impossible. You need those. I mean, absolutely. The sponsors, I mean, are critical. And I think until we can scale, I mean, you know, there are five jobs like mine in the world right now. That's not enough, right? There are probably, I mean, that's within future Earth. There are probably, what, 25, 50 at most, really in this position to be able to do this kind of work full time. And it isn't enough. It is far more than there used to be. There is a growing acceptance of the value of this kind of work. But until like the and that is, I think, due explicitly to these early adopting sponsors. So Cambridge, for example, a good example of, you know, also working with actually some of the same sponsors as the Luke Hoffman Institute to create the Cambridge Conservation Initiative, which has now blossomed into something that really puts, you know, 25 or 30 civil society organizations together with a world-class institution in the same building and put some money in the center so they have to work together. Because incentive structures are pretty simple for scientists and really for all of us. If you can incentivize us to come together and try and figure out how to form trust relationships to create solutions to challenges, we'll do it. We'll do it in civil society. We'll do it in science. We'll figure out our cultural differences. But without that incentive structure in place, we won't. And so those early adopting sponsors are critical. And now it needs to be mainstreamed. Like we need organizations like the Belmont Forum and others to go beyond the need to connect across geography and the need to connect across disciplines and to support this process of how do you actually, you know, support scientists that work and engage with other sectors of society regularly. It's fundamentally difficult. I mean, one sort of example I think is really important is in climate, in biodiversity, in action in these areas. We have the Green Climate Fund. We have the Global Environmental Facility. These are financial facilities that allow us to pool money across nations and then deliver that money into the sectors in the nations that need to act most rapidly and will have the biggest impact on whether it's biodiversity conservation or whether it's climate mitigation. We don't have anything like that for research. There is no, like 99.9% of the sustainability problems that need research are international and cross-disciplinary. 99.99% of research funding is within national boundaries and disciplinary. That mismatch is slowing us in our ability to reach the sustainable development goals to a huge extent. And it's hampering, it's tying the hands of research communities all over the planet because we can't work together right now because the funding won't allow us to. We need to crack that nut.
But how?
Well, how did the Global Environmental Facility get started? How did the Green Climate Fund get started? These are nations getting together and recognizing, in the case of science, that science was created for national competitiveness. That's no longer the reason to do science. Let's get over that fact. Let's recognize that we're no longer just trying to have science and innovation to make our country have a greater GDP than your country. But we need to retool these systems so that that same fuel is used for all of us to work more effectively to save all of our asses.
But those on the receiving end of research money and those on the giving end of research money increasingly see this, and yet nothing changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So this is where you have to be an optimist, right? Because I feel like change, the nature of transformations is they change slow and they change slow and they change slow until they've changed. And they're totally different. Right. And so we wouldn't expect a linear transformation in the funding either. And I do think that what the Belmont Forum is doing is this really wonderfully insurgent approach to building support around the world for funding that crosses disciplinary and international borders. And it is painful and it is tooth pulling and it is difficult to get nations on board. And it is service to sustainability. And what it does more than anything is change people's ideas of what is possible and change people's ideas within funding agencies. Wait, we can do this. Maybe we can do this better. Maybe we can do this a lot better. Maybe we can invest more in this. You know, I do feel like that, you know, it's a very small part of the scientific funding structure. They give away maybe less than $100 million a year, quite a bit less than that. And it's, as a researcher, a lot of people complain about it's hard to get. There's all these rules and it's tough, but they're experimenting And they're trying to figure out how public sector funders can come together to pool their money in new ways to create opportunities for research communities that weren't there 5 years ago. Fundamentally, what will it look like 5 years from now or 10 years? If I had to guess, I would say it will be much more integrative, and it won't just be public sector. There will be much more involvement from development aid organizations. There'll be much more involvement from private sector philanthropies. Funders are coming together around science, technology, and innovation for the sustainable development goals and trying to figure out how you work together more effectively. And right now it seems still a little bit chaotic and confused, but I do feel like we're in an exponential change in the funding community as well.
And do you see, looking ahead, more of a democratization of who gets to solve the problem as well?
Yeah, so I really like the, there's these, a group called Open IDEO does these challenge grants with other funders that I think are fantastic. And we've actually worked with them somewhat to try and design some challenges ourselves. And I think what they've done is decide that, you know, the traditional way of, I mean, the fundamental question I think you want to ask when you're giving away money for research is, how do you benefit not just the few individuals who get the money? How do you actually use the research process and the competition for research dollars as a way to create community and to create open access to ideas? Because for every proposal that's funded, there are at least 40 that should have been funded. But if we do this in a closed space where no one are exchanging ideas, those 40 proposals die on the vine. We don't need to do it that way. And there are groups that are thinking about how we collaboratively in a community forum source good ideas, exchange good ideas, create community, and build successful proposals that can actually have greater impact, even if they don't get funded the first time around. So I think there's lots of innovation in how we think about funding. And it's all on the same trajectory of democratization of science, that maybe we shouldn't just be having science calls for, you know, for certain card-carrying scientists. But maybe we should have calls that are a bit more integrative, that introduce the need for science, but embed that into calls that are more focused on development, for example. Like, you know, USAID does a tremendous amount of work around the world, and so does CETA, and so does IRDC. The three of them have a very hard time working together. These are the Canadian, the US, and the Swedish development agencies. And but they all work in the same countries to some extent, and all of them struggle to figure out how to bake science and research into their development work and how to build the evidence base for sustainability. They don't need to be near as separate as they are. And they're increasingly coming together. So when we think about funding for change, we need to think about integrative funding that combines the needs of an organization like USAID or CETA or IRDRC with the needs of funding organizations like DFID or NSF or DFG in Germany. Like the different groups need to continue to talk about how to meet their combined agenda, because sustainability is about innovation, science, and technology. And that innovation is as much about governance innovation and social innovation as it is about any sort of widget we might create. So connecting these dots is critical. I mean, just the last piece in the thing that I think is like one piece that I've been working on a bunch and I haven't quite solved yet, but you know, you can bring together $15 million in research funding for ocean sustainability, which you know Belmont Forum is doing with us soon. And if we could get $1 million of funding that wasn't for research, but just to connect that research outcome to potential market opportunities, you'd probably double the outcome, right? Because what happens right now is you create these phenomenal research engines, but the people who are doing that work have no capacity to think clearly about market opportunities to scale their discoveries. And we don't even consider that as a part of the research process. And so a whole bunch of good ideas take a long time to get out into the market and out into organizations that can effectively scale them. That's one part of the academic system.
I think you see that on any university campus anywhere around the world.
Yeah.
This whole commercialization of knowledge business. How do you scale? You know, the drawers are full of IP.
The drawers are full of IP, right? But the problem is that how we see it right now is a competitive approach in which each university is trying to capitalize on its own IP. That's going completely, and I understand why they do that, but it's completely counter to the sort of more team science approach, in which what we need is the actual process of taking ideas from that whole ecosystem needs to shift, so that you don't just bring individual ideas up, but you allow, I guess we were talking about this before offline when we were talking about spreading of risk, right? Business schools around the world don't just want one idea that they need to either invest in or not. They need a way of, if you're going to, not just business schools, but if you're going to take, philanthropy or venture capital, they need ways of really understanding a landscape and making sort of bets on a lot of little things so that some of them will come to fruition. But I don't think we actually give that venture capital a lot of good signals on what that landscape looks like. Like, it's hard to figure out where potential innovations could come from. And part of that is because we don't do a lot of transfer at the level, we don't do a lot of institutional linkage between the thinking that goes into a business plan and the thinking that goes into the innovation and knowledge creation within a primarily academic discipline.
And I wonder how much of that is down to also the lack of joined upness between commercial interests or society at large in terms of the questions they're asking,
sure,
versus the questions, the research questions.
Absolutely. So this is a huge struggle, right? Because, and it's a hard community to change, right? Because research communities go to their own to determine the quality of the work and which work gets funded. And that's quite useful if you're not in a change situation. But it is going to make you the slowest horse on the track if you are in a change situation, right? Because we have created a tremendously self-referential system in which, if you want to know what the most important thing in ocean science is, you turn to the oldest, most distinguished ocean scientists, which are not likely to be the ones most connected to the needs of civil society, public sector, and private sector around sustainable oceans. It's not their fault. They're just not likely to be those people. So how do you create a funding structure or an alternative ecosystem that allows and rewards and builds the links between the edgier part of science, right? The science that is not quite as disciplinarily nailed down, but has the potential to shift systems, not 100 years from now, but 5 or 10 years from now. How do you reward and connect those communities and give them alternatives? Because it's not as if you're trying to do away with the other. You just need more ways of supporting the academic enterprise for the very different landscape it's in today. It is not just about knowledge creation, and we somehow will throw that knowledge over a wall and hope it hits a passing problem. That's not going to be good enough anymore. So how do you provide those mechanisms? And I think the funders are starting to think about it.
That sounds like a research question to our audience.
Oh, that'd be great. So we've actually submitted some proposals on this. So, I work in this thing called the Sustainability Innovation Lab where my hub is built. And, so we've put together these business incubators for the link between, knowledge systems and business systems to come together. And we've written these things and submitted them to the Gates Foundation and to some other great, great organizations. But the hardest thing in writing these proposals is that it's really hard to find who to point to who's doing this right now in the development space. Like in that space between, in the sustainability and development space, where is that successful incubator model that consistently connects research communities and innovation communities that can scale and build in the venture capital and build in the philanthropic dollars to scale an idea, to take it out to market? Not in the US necessarily or the UK, but in those much more distributed markets that characterize the developing worlds or the BRICS, for example, that are where these innovations are going to have really big impacts,
right?
In India, in China, in much of Africa. Like, where's that link between idea generation and development that powers the engine of transformation in the economies that need it most? I can't find them. There's some great startups, but no one's that I've found has actually said, yes, this works. This is the way.
I don't think there's enough people thinking about the systemic level of the innovation pipeline, the whole innovation ecosystem, and how you support it at all the different stages along the way.
Right.
Now, there's too much self-interest, you know, further down the line in terms of, you know, getting a 10x, 100x, 1000x return, you know, looking for an exit strategy and all that kind of stuff. And at the front end, there's too much, you know, there's too little thinking about, well, how you scale. There's a valley of death in the middle somewhere,
right,
where the entrepreneur or the innovator carries all of the risk around the success or otherwise.
And so it seems like some of your best academic institutions have their own labs like this. I'm thinking like Solve at MIT or some of the others, and they're really interesting. My only critique is that, you know, what we need is we need things that cross institutional boundaries. I mean, MIT has a phenomenal faculty. They do tremendous work in development studies and in technology and in media. So they're a great, great, great group to work with. They're not the only ones, and they have big gaps like any university will. And if you're an organization like Future Earth or WWF or any other civil society organization, you can't afford to work with just one educational institution. Your goals are global. So you need systems that combine the very best capacities across the world's best educational institutions, bring them together around the critical problems that need near-term solutions, combine that talent with the IP and entrepreneurial capacity from around the world, and put it in a tight box that allows change to take place. You know, really, really well-organized, facilitated structures. I think it's all possible, but I haven't seen anyone do it yet.
Let's do it.
Maybe we got a job.
Let's do it. So, listening to you, Josh, I mean, you're such an optimist. I mean, you talk about some really big intractable problems here, but in such an optimistic tone. You know, we should all feel hopeful that the solution's out there somewhere. God knows there'll be people listening who are probably working on them already.
I think there are. I know there are. Yeah. You can't know all the good things that are happening. That's one of the great, great things about the job I have, which I love, is that, you know, so much of the work is getting done on the ground. Like, I feel like the downside of my job is I'm a little bit too high above it to be able to get my sleeves rolled up. All I can do is champion all those that are rolling up their sleeves and just getting on with it. You know, just coming up with solutions, whether that's like, oh, you know, we don't need cows to create milk anymore. And that's actually kind of a cool thing when you think about the impacts that, you know, cattle have on our environment. You know, it also has some interesting ethical side points, but it's really interesting innovations like that in all sorts of sectors. Big wood skyscrapers, going back to wood instead of metal, that save all sorts of stuff, reinventing cement, like thinking about, you know, the major problems we face in a solutions orientation in sector after sector after sector. Like, I just feel honored to be able to actually champion that work.
So you, looking back to how you got started measuring the hotness of chilies, you've come quite a way to sort of considering the big global systemic challenges that we face for science and for society. Are you conscious at any point in time that your scale of ambition kind of elevated, or was it very incremental? Did it just sort of take place over time?
I do feel like, there were definitely a couple of points at which the scale gets elevated. And I think going into even graduate school, I was very optimistic. I didn't really even know I wanted to be a scientist. I just wanted to continue to work with the critters around the world and the landscapes that I loved a bunch and the people who lived in them. But there's something that happens when you connect across disciplines that is really important for, I think, academics who haven't done it successfully to do again and again to get it right, because it opens your mind and your ability to respect the tremendous talent that comes from such a wide range of disciplines within academia. And then there's like another door when you start really recognizing how much talent and innovation is completely outside the academic space. And I think academics, we're famous for creating small fishbowls so we can be the big fish. And we do that in the way we publish, and the way we talk to each other, and the way we organize ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with doing that to some extent, as long as you also recognize that you've actually constrained yourself to a relatively small fishbowl, and that's why you're such a big fish. The job, you know, I think it's wonderfully humbling and really exciting to be at the side of a bigger table. And every time the two spaces that I think shifted were with, oh, civil society. Is not just, you know, civil society has a tremendous amount to offer and an incredible flexibility and entrepreneurialism that's quite close to the private sector. And that's super exciting. And once you recognize that, even as an academic, I think it just opens up your ability to think more broadly. And then I think the other piece is like just getting out of your national frame. There's a tremendous amount to do in any one country. And so I don't think everyone has to work internationally. But I do think recognizing how your work fits into the larger international picture is critical and creating those links. And each time that I was able to do that, I was just exposed to a greater group of people with differing talents that I, you know, just soaked up and felt and it actually makes me more positive about the world.
Do you think that the 10 years spent looking at chilies in the rainforest was a necessary foundation for the work you're doing now? Or do you look back at how you spent those early years and wish you'd got started on doing this bigger scale stuff sooner?
That's a great question. I feel like if I didn't do that, I would. I may not have the same level of support, empathy, credibility, and connectedness to the deep work of understanding our world, which I will always recognize as critical. And I think we always do a disservice to others when we try and suggest that the work they do is less than fundamental to the work. Like, so, you know, academics are famous of this, and so are other sectors of society. We tend to think of ourselves as the what we're doing is the most important part of the piece. And I think by going deep in academia and by recognizing that, you know, that academic excellence, that deep devotion to understanding a system requires a lifetime of patience. And Gene Likens, when he discovered acid rain, was measuring streams because all he cared about were streams and invertebrates and streams. He was a natural historian bent on understanding how streams worked. And he was the guy who daylighted acid rain and led to a revolution in management that ended up controlling that problem. So there is no shame in doing nothing but academics. And there's fundamental value in all of that understanding. And if I hadn't have been one, I don't think I could actually, you know, represent that community as well, and be able to listen to what's keeping them from fulfilling their own dreams, and, you know, and value, and to be able just to value that fundamental work they do. So I do think it was important that I did that. And I feel like in an organization like Future Earth, we are fundamentally a science organization first, working to make that science much more nimble and to create an information system that's actually fit for purpose in today's world. If you're going to do that, you have to be able to connect to the world we live in today and to the problems that are emergent in the lives of those people who are creating knowledge. I think if you aren't a part of the system, it's hard to do that well.
What's your own version of pre-traumatic stress? What's the legacy that you hope for that Josh Tewksbury leaves behind?
I think in the last 10 or 12 years, I've been pretty focused on thinking about evaluating whether what I was doing was having an impact. And I think for me, that impact is around creating change and helping to support transformation of you know, any number of societal systems that are going to need to change and actually just will change given the pressures of our pressures on the planet and the pressures of that planet back on us. And I don't think much about legacy in that, because I think part of it is like an individual legacy. You know, if there's a really large individual legacy, it'll be around just the people I care most about. And the field itself is going to be, you know, it's going to be changed because we work together. And, you know, the hope, I guess, is that collaborative work creates a legacy that is much more inclusive than previous sort of scientific legacies, and looks a lot more like the world than like me. In other words, I'm acutely aware of the benefits that I have had in my career by being a white man in a developed country. And if I could leave a legacy, it is that people who are not white and are not men and are not in developed countries have just as much capacity to create change in the world. And their path to impact is cleared of the obstacles that currently lie before them. I think that's fundamentally where we need to go.
Josh, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Tony. This is great. I really, really wish you luck in the whole podcast. I think it's a phenomenal idea. And when it comes out, we're super excited to collaborate with Anthropocene. So it will be fun.
Look forward to
that.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Tony.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.